From NPR and WBUR Boston, I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. This is Here and Now. President Biden is in Houston today. His itinerary includes touring a food bank and meeting with emergency workers. His Texas visit comes after the winter storm that knocked out power and water for days. Meanwhile, in Washington, the House is likely to pass the nearly $2 trillion economic relief bill. Here's how Democratic Representative Jim McGovern of Massachusetts made the case on the House floor this morning.
We are here because people are hurting and communities are struggling. This is our moment. This is our chance to act boldly and help them. And I hope we seize it.
Republicans oppose the bill, and the nonpartisan Senate parliamentarian effectively killed a proposal to include a $15 minimum wage increase. NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell joins us now. Hi, Kelsey.
Hi there.
And we don't often talk about the Senate parliamentarian, but she did make this very important ruling that Democrats now can't include the minimum wage hike in the relief bill. So who is this parliamentarian and why did she make that decision?
She is basically the keeper of the rules in the Senate. And, you know, in this specific case, it's her job to determine if individual elements of this bill fit within budget reconciliation. And that's because Democrats chose to use the budget process and a part of the budget process known as reconciliation to try to pass this coronavirus relief bill without having to worry about a filibuster. That means they can pass it without any Republican support, but it means they have to adhere to some kind of complicated rules about what fits a Senate budget bill. In this case, it seems, and we should say this is a very opaque process, something that happens behind closed doors and we only find out about it later. It seems that her decision here was based on whether or not the minimum wage increase is primarily budget related and does it change revenues or expenditures as its primary objective. And the ruling seems to be that it didn't do that. It didn't fit the definition of something that is budgetary in nature. It's more of a regulatory thing is what some analysts have pointed out. And, you know, experts have argued that the wage has an impact on businesses and individuals, not on the budget, and so it was removed from this specific bill.
It was removed from this bill that the House Democrats will be voting on today.
The House Democrats are keeping it in their version, but once it comes over to the Senate, it will have to be removed for the bill to be considered on the Senate floor.
Okay, I see. Thank you. So Democrats have been working on this bill for weeks. Where did they end up? What else should we know about what's in it?
This bill, aside from the $15 minimum wage, is largely unchanged from the plan that President Biden himself revealed last month. It includes $1,400 checks, a maximum of $1,400 stimulus checks for most people. It includes an increase in federal unemployment benefits from $300 a week to $400 a week, and it would go from the middle of March all the way through the end of August. There's also more money for small business loans, more money for one of the interesting things, a grant programs for restaurants and bars. And I think one of the things people are going to be watching most closely is a change to the child tax credit that would essentially make it a monthly payment of between $250 and $300 for most people from the middle of July through the end of this year. So there are some major changes in this bill.
And briefly, we had mentioned that Republicans not on board with this. In fact, they've been saying that Democrats are using the bill to advance policies that are unrelated to COVID-19. What are they pointing to and saying today?
They are pointing to a lot of those programs like the child tax credit and money for humanities and arts and things like that. Democrats say that this is a bill aimed at sending relief to places that were hurt in the COVID economy, essentially. And they argue that that is all related to coronavirus.
All right. We'll be watching the vote today. NPR congressional correspondent Kelsey Snell, thank you.
Thanks for having me.
The wounds of the sexual abuse crisis in USA Gymnastics remain even after the suicide of one of the men at the center of that scandal. John Getter died by suicide yesterday, according to Michigan's attorney general, who just hours earlier had charged him with dozens of crimes related to the abuse, including human trafficking. Getter was close with Larry Nassar, the former USA Gymnastics team doctor, who was convicted of dozens of cases of sexual abuse in 2018 and sentenced to life in prison. Rachel Denhollander was the first woman to publicly accuse Nassar of sexual abuse back in 2016, and she joins us now. Rachel, thank you so much for being here.
Thank you so much for having me.
Let's start with the charges here. Michigan's attorney general surprised some by including charges of human trafficking. What was your reaction to those charges?
I'm very grateful for the incredible work that the attorney general put in and just the The willingness to really pursue justice and to look at the reality of what Gethardt was doing. The human trafficking charge is actually related to Gethardt's own abuse and the financial benefit he derived from his athletes that he was beating and starving. And I think this is something we need to grapple with far more often, is what we can do legally to hold abusers accountable for the incredible devastation that they've caused.
Well, the scope of these charges suggests a level of abuse and an even wider attempt to cover it up than has been previously reported. If it isn't too painful to talk about, would you help us understand what role John Gethardt played in the abuse you suffered and the abuse you were witness to?
So John was Larry Nassar's good friend. They went way back to well before John even owned the gym named Twist Stars that really made him famous. And Larry was the team physician for Twist Stars. And so it really created this perfect dynamic, this perfect storm, where John would be the physically abusive, emotionally abusive coach, you know, picking his athletes up and throwing them at times, throwing equipment at them, forcing them to train on catastrophic injuries, going so far as to tell them routinely to kill themselves, starving his athletes. And what that did is it allowed Larry to come in as the doctor and essentially role play as the safe person. The person who could be trusted. And so these gymnasts of John's, as they were experiencing this horrific abuse from Gethardt, would find refuge in Larry. Larry would bring them food. Larry would be the person who appeared to care about their injuries. But in reality, he was using that as a cover to sexually assault gymnasts at Twistar's gym every day. And we have a lot of reason to believe that John knew what was going on. Yeah, there's an instance where he walked in while Larry was abusing a young gymnast and made a vulgar remark about how badly her back must have hurt for her to be receiving that kind of treatment. He allowed Larry to treat gymnasts in a closed back room in the gym with a papered-over window. But that's really a dynamic that is stereotypical for USAG. The level of abuse that is taking place in this sport from Olympic coaches all the way down to club level coaches has been an open secret for decades.
After Gethardt's death was reported, you tweeted, quote, "So much pain and grief for everyone. To the survivors, you have been heard and believed, and we stand with you. Thank you for telling the truth. What you have done matters. Please stay safe. You are loved and wanted here," end quote. What have you been hearing, Rachel, from other survivors about the charges and now about Gethardt's death by suicide?
So I want to be careful not to disclose any confidences from other survivors. Their stories are their own. But, you know, we have the same dynamics here that you would have in any kind of situation where there's been this kind of extensive trauma. There's just great devastation at how long it took for Gethardt to be held responsible for his crimes. The fact that his behavior was known for decades and no one cared enough to do anything about it until just now. There's great devastation, the fact that these survivors are not going to get their day in court. Yeah, they put their lives on hold to participate with this criminal investigation. And so my heart is just really grieved for them, but also hoping that they're able to hold on to the truth about the incredible change that they've created. They have stopped an abuser, and they're dismantling the systems that enabled him. And that's a very powerful thing.
The Michigan Attorney General is still investigating Michigan State University, and a press release from her office yesterday notes that the investigation, quote, remains inconclusive. As many as 6,000 documents in the possession of the university have not been released, end quote. Rachel, how can that be? And what do you still hope to see from these investigations as they continue?
Yeah, that's the question all of us are asking. How can that be? How can we be 4 years down the road and Michigan State University is still prioritizing money over the safety of their current students and over the safety of the survivors who underwent such trauma to shine a light on what was going on? You know, the worst sexual assault scandal in sports history took place on their campus, and they still care more about money than they do about answers and about healing for the survivors. They don't want to risk losing insurance proceeds. That's abominable, and it's unconscionable.
Watching these legal proceedings grind on and all that's happened here must be incredibly difficult for you and so many others. Do you feel, Rachel, that justice is being served for all the pain that has been caused?
Absolutely not. Because the reality is that the systems and the leaders that enabled these abusers have yet to take any responsibility for what's taken place. You know, we're not expecting the most basic things from these leaders. I've got 4 young kids, and when one of my kids does something that hurts another child, I require them to go through a very specific process. You identify what went wrong, You acknowledge the damage that you caused, and you ask what needs to happen moving forward. And yet the grown adults of Michigan State University and USA Gymnastics can't do the most basic things that we require of our children.
That is Rachel Denhollander, the first woman to accuse Larry Nassar, the former USA Gymnastics team doctor, of sexual abuse back in 2016. She's author of the memoir, What is a Girl Worth? Rachel, I appreciate your voice so much. Thank you for speaking with us today.
Thank you so much for having me.
Long before Gigi Hadid, Kendall Jenner, and Gisele Bündchen graced the runway of Fashion Week, there was Beverly Johnson and Naomi Ruth Sims. Naomi Ruth Sims was the first African-American model to appear on the cover of Ladies' Home Journal in 1968 and Life magazine in 1969. Beverly Johnson was famously known as the first African-American model on the cover of Vogue in 1974. In honor of Black History Month, EdgeExpo.com is offering a glimpse into the lives of eight Black fashion makers and Black influencers who use the power of fashion to transform their identity and culture. Fashion Culture, a Study of Eight, was curated by Rhonda Hill. She joins us now. So nice to have you, Rhonda.
Thank you. I'm very happy to be here.
Rhonda, this is a curated project that covers people and events of culture and historical significance between the years of 1880 and 1980. The photographs online are extraordinary, and we will link people to them at our website, hereandnow.org. But first, explain to us the inspiration behind the Study of Eight. What inspired you to do this?
Well, you know, for a long time, I've been meaning to do a project like this. It's always good to target it around the Black History Month time period. But it also ties in with the EDGE objectives and values, which is to showcase the work of those that are underrepresented. And so this project was, was a very in-depth study of how there's parts of history that we leave out. African Americans have contributed to fashion in ways that we just don't know about. And I felt like I wanted to really let their voices be being heard.
Well, the Study of Eight is broken down into an eight-part series that begins with the cotton factory. Tell us why you decided to start there.
Well, when I was putting the Study of Eight together, the time period is against the backdrop of the Jim Crow era and the civil rights movement. So in this example of the cotton factory, the good, the bad, and the ugly, the good part was that Coleman Manufacturing Company was the only Black-owned and operated and employed Blacks within that cotton mill. So that was a progressive stance. The oppressed piece of it is the bad and the ugly. Discriminatory labor practices were well-known back then against the Blacks, of course. The white mill owners really exploited cheap labor practices against the white employees that wanted to work. So they felt like in order to save costs, using Black labor at a lower cost would obviously save them money. The ugly part of it is that the white men in the community felt a need to say something and defend what they felt were privileged, their wives and daughters, because female labor was cheaper. Their wives and daughters were working at these mills. And so they wanted to raise their voice and really push against this exploitation of using Black labor. This was a period in our time that, although you see progression, there is this oppressed discriminatory practices that were happening within the industry.
Explain the process behind this project, Rhonda, and why you chose to focus on the people that you did. Just some extraordinary people. W.E.B. Du Bois, Elizabeth Hobbs Keckley, Amanda Gorman. Tell me about them.
Well, what I wanted to do was touch on the different parts of our history over this 100 period time frame. And I wanted to acknowledge those that were pioneers, like the supermodels and the Black fashion designers. But I also wanted to highlight the events like Ebony Fashion Fair and the Battle of Versailles. So the first are those first black fashion designers, Elizabeth Hobbs Keckley, Fannie Chris Payne, Ann Cole Lowe, and Zelda Valdez, what they did was they had power in creating fashion, and yet their own appearance and talent got them the clientele they sought. So they really used the power of dress, not only in their in appearance, but in obviously in their creations. And so they sought after society elite. So they kind of set the stage back then as far as those pioneers.
So people like Elizabeth Hobbs Keckley, who is best known as yes. Mary Lincoln's dressmaker and confidant. Yes. I mean, yes. she did make a name for herself, but through the powerful Mary Lincoln.
That's correct. Yes. The others, for example, Ann Cole Lowe was known for creating the wedding gown and gowns for the bridal party for Jackie Kennedy. And here again, these women were far hidden from any kind of history, acknowledging their work until recent decades.
Mildred Blount made spectacular hats, and she was the first African-American member of the Motion Pictures Costumers Union.
Yes, yes. She actually did the work for the hats for that were worn by Scarlett O'Hara for Gone with the Wind.
Yes. You also included Amanda Gorman. And actually, you'd already written Study of Eight when you decided to include her.
Yes.
Because you,
yes.
like the rest of us, were blown away by her poetry, yes. by who she is.
Yes. The Study of Eight had been put to bed, and we were just in the editing process. And then when I saw her captivating poem, what it reminded me was that some of those verses that she had really identified with my desire and responsibility to bring this work to the readers.
Being American is more than a pride we inherit. It's the past we step into and how we repair it.
I felt like that was very appropriate with what the work I was doing. So I was very touched by that.
Give me another example of someone from this Study of Eight.
Well, the black supermodels, I think what's important about them is that the black community did not have model representation in a mainstream fashion magazines until the horrible times of the 60s, when Danielle and Naomi and Beverly were the first blacks to grace the covers. So finally, there was inclusion and respect, and the power of fashion neutralized those biases.
Mm.
Because when I think about this, and most people will think of this about this, when you dress a black model or a white model, you get the same outcome. You get fashion. And when you lay this up against what was going on at the time, the contrast is extraordinary. Danielle Luna is on the cover of Harper's Bazaar, January of 65, British Vogue, March of 66. And when you look at even the year of 1968, April and June were the assassinations of Martin Luther King Jr. and Bobby Kennedy. And also within that year, James Brown in August, who was, as most blacks were fed up with what was going on as far as inequality, he released his popular hit song, Say It Loud, I'm Black and I'm Proud.
Say it loud!
All this was going on. Months later, November of that same year, Naomi Sims is on the cover of Ladies Home Journal, and almost a year later on the cover of Life.
You spent 8 months working on this project. What struck you most about your findings?
I was enlightened. I was disappointed and disgusted at times. There was a lot of the history that I didn't even know about. And there was times when I stayed in character. Everything would be through the lens of what I was experiencing because I was born in the civil rights era. So I took myself back into those times because these stories haven't really come to life until really in the last decades. Mm. And I'm just now learning about the dynamic of what happened with how the American fashion system really turned the corner with the Battle of Versailles fashion show there in France.
And why was that so significant? What was it about that moment?
It was a game changer, not only for American fashion, but African-American models. The African-American designer, Stephen Burroughs, got a lot of press from that show. And fashion was literally on the front stage, but fashion and the black models transformed the perception of American fashion and American black culture. So this was an event that I really didn't have much knowledge about it, but because of the oral history and because of books that were written, and there's two documentaries out there, you know, I was able to learn a lot about this part of our fashion history.
And lastly, I know that there are important questions to still be answered about what the fashion industry can do to be more inclusive today.
There are. I'd say that I think the fashion industry has gotten lazy over time. The process is not that inclusive, not only in the BIPOC community, but in the underrepresented, those independents, the up-and-coming designers. My hope is that a study of eight is, you know, we can get beyond its reputation of fluff and frivolous and have more of an intelligent way at looking at fashion as a transformative piece in cultural identity and inclusion and respect and recognition.
Well, that's what you have done for us today. Rhonda Hill is the author of Fashion Culture, A Study of Eight. It's a curated editorial project advancing the study of African Americans' contribution to fashion history. Rhonda Hill, thank you so, so much. What a pleasure to speak with you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Support for Here and Now and the following message come from Zooty. Why spend months coding when you can build powerful, customized applications in days? Zooty offers an affordable solution to build apps for your business, apps that integrate into all your current systems and data sources. And your Zooty subscription always includes unlimited apps and unlimited users. Learn more at Zooty.com.
He was one of the most consequential architects of the civil rights movement, but you may never have heard of him.
For our Black History Month special series, Bayard Rustin, who made nonviolence part of the fight for civil rights and organized the March on Washington.
Listen now to the Throughline podcast from NPR.
Today, Syria is condemning U.S. airstrikes against militia groups in the eastern part of that country, calling them cowardly and a violation of international law. Those militias have the backing of Iran, and these airstrikes mark the first military offensive of Joe Biden's presidency. Let's bring in Here and Now security analyst Jim Walsh. He's with the MIT Security Studies Program. Jim, welcome.
Good to be with you, Peter.
Good to have you. And the U.S. government says this strike was retaliation for a February 15th rocket attack that killed an American contractor and injured a member of the U.S. military. Do you think it was an appropriate response?
Well, there were actually three separate attacks that were sort of clustered closely together. And the U.S. is saying, well, it's kind of saying it is responding to those earlier attacks, but it's really not directly tying with evidence those attacks to the groups that actually hit today. Those are groups that the U.S. has hit before, and it seems like in this case, perhaps the intention is possibly deterrence, you know, don't do things in the future, or maybe disruption because they're associated with smuggling arms into Iraq. You know, at the most general level, it's probably saying, if you hit me, I'll hit you. Of course, in the Middle East, everyone has a different story as to who threw the first punch. But the targets we hit are people we've tangled with before. And I think the big picture here, Peter, is militias are a bit of a wild card factor. They're very hard to get rid of. Iraq has gotten rid of them before, but it's a big bloody job. So given what's happened in Iraq with ISIS and all the rest, I don't think this is going away anytime soon.
All right, let's hear from Secretary of Defense Lloyd Austin, who spoke with reporters earlier this morning.
We're very deliberate about our approach, as you would expect us to be. We allowed and encouraged the Iraqis to investigate and develop intelligence, and that was very helpful to us in refining the target.
I think it's worth hearing that, Jim, because the last time the Trump administration conducted strikes in Iraq, Iraq claimed its sovereignty had been violated, and then there were violent protests that followed. Do you think that the Biden administration took that into consideration?
Oh, absolutely. But it also would not have been difficult for them to do that. Why? Because Iraq wants two things. It doesn't want the U.S. to take unilateral military action inside its country without its permission, so it doesn't want that. But it also doesn't want militias firing off rockets and killing people. Iraq doesn't want any militias. You know, something that was an issue right after the war in Iraq, and then they sort of got them under control, and then it all swelled up again after the ISIS invasion of Iraq and the Iraqi army collapsed. But it doesn't want to be a battlefield between the U.S. and other, you know, Iran or other people in the region, and it wants to control its own territory. So I'm sure it's more than happy to cooperate against the militias, but it doesn't want to be sort of a bystander when attacks take place on its territory.
And just briefly, what kind of statement does this make to Iran as Washington and Tehran are considering potentially difficult talks over resuming the nuclear deal?
Well, the signal to Iran is really just a general one to all the players in the region. I think they're trying to say the U.S. will respond to attacks on its forces with attacks on others who threaten them. I don't think it'll have much impact either way on rejoining the agreement on a compliance-for-compliance basis. That's going to sink or swim on its own.
Here and Now security analyst Jim Walsh, thank you so much.
Thanks, Peter.
The Conservative Political Action Conference, or CPAC, opened today in Orlando, Florida. It features a number of supporters of former President Donald Trump, and of course, Trump himself will speak on Sunday. But one person who will not be there is Al Cardenas, the former chair of the American Conservative Union, the parent organization of the conference and former chair of the Florida Republican Party. Al Cardenas joins us now via Skype. Welcome and nice to have you.
Well, it's great to be with you. Thank you.
So why won't you be attending CPAC this year?
Well, it's changed. You know, as a former chairman of the organization, if I don't have anything positive to say, it's good form not to show up and be there. CPAC's been around more than 50 years, and I supported it from the outset. I was on its board for 15 years, and I am sad to see during the last few years, it's not representative of what I loved about CPAC.
Well, Donald Trump Jr. will be there, as well as Senator Josh Hawley of Missouri, the former Secretary of State Mike Pompeo as well. What's your reaction to the lineup of speakers at CPAC?
Many of the folks lined up to speak, especially the five or six panels that they have, are all designed to prolong this concept that the election's been stolen. And I have a real serious problem with that. January 6th was no accident. I think that people reacted violently to the president's and his surrogate speaking about elections being stolen. I believe the election was fair. The courts of the country believed the elections were fair. And last and foremost, if you don't believe in the fairness of the elections, you don't believe that we have a democracy to stand on. And that's not right. Prolonging that elections were stolen lie is wrong for America. It's wrong for what we believe in. And it's not the rule of law. It's dangerous.
So, as you say, the speakers include many who backed the former president's false claims of a stolen election. And there are a number of sessions at CPAC on, quote, protecting elections. So just to follow up on what you just said, is this going to be an outlet for more false conspiracy theories about the election? And does that surprise you, given the attack on the Capitol January 6th by some people who touted those very theories?
Well, it doesn't surprise me, given the tenor of this. Just this very morning, there was a rollout of a Donald Trump golden figure, kind of like the biblical golden statues. And that idolatry is not healthy for our country. But whether it's idolatry or not, what's not healthy for our country is continuing to promote the big lie about the election being stolen and continuing to have certain folks out there take to the streets in a violent manner. Hundreds of people have been arrested for the January 6th event, and I'm just fearful that that situation is far from over.
Politico first reported that former Vice President Pence declined an invitation to speak at CPAC this weekend. Former South Carolina Governor Nikki Haley also will not speak. I mentioned those who will be speaking. What do you take from the list of people who either aren't speaking or, like yourself, are not going at all?
Well, what it says is that those people who've decided to align their political futures following Donald Trump's star will echo that which Donald Trump will have to say. And it's an uncomfortable place to be in if you believe that that's a lie and if you believe it's counterproductive to the party. There have been tens of thousands, if not hundreds of thousands, of Republicans who've switched parties since January 6th. And my sense is that the Donald Trump idolatry will continue to shrink my party, and that will hurt us in the short end and the long run.
So to keep that from happening, what should the Republican Party then be focusing on right now?
It should be focusing on policies. It should be a loyal opposition to the Congress and the president. It should continue to focus on whether the COVID relief bill is fiscally sound. It should continue to debate in a constructive way an immigration reform bill. When the party concentrates on policy, it does fairly well. When the party gets to the streets in this Donald Trump fashion, it shrinks, not only in size, but in stature. And I would love to see my party return to policy discussions.
Al Cardenas is the former chair of the American Conservative Union, the parent organization of the conference. He's also senior partner of Squire, Patton & Boggs. Al Cardenas, thank you very much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
My pleasure.
Let's take a few minutes now to remember a medical pioneer. Dr. Bernard Laun was credited with developing the defibrillator and was a well-known peace activist. He died last week at the age of 99. David Freudberg from the Humankind Public Radio series covered his work and life over the years and has this remembrance.
It was in the early 1960s that Bernard Laun first invited fellow doctors to his home outside Boston to discuss the existential threat of nuclear weapons. Initially, he encountered some pushback. Was it the place of physicians to get involved in a political issue? After much deliberation, his doctor's group proceeded and went on to win the Nobel Peace Prize for their efforts to prevent nuclear war. For Bernard Laun, it was always about public health, protecting and serving human beings.
Most people who come to doctors, the vast majority, have small problems of the hurly-burly of living, the stresses and strains that amplify every complaint conceivable.
Born in Lithuania, he emigrated as a teenager to Maine with his family. His father was a rabbi. Dr. Laun went on to become a storied Harvard cardiologist, advancing a device used to revive people whose hearts had suddenly stopped beating. But he was dissatisfied with much of modern healthcare. In his book, The Lost Art of Healing, he concluded that the central problem is not economic, although he favored Medicare for all. It was, he told me in 2001, the system where caring is supplanted by managing.
In olden times, you had an aunt, a grandmother, an extended family who had a lot of common sense and experience and would assuage the anxiety and therefore annul the symptoms.
But he said that no longer exists, and doctors are instead so focused on the technology, causing what he calls an imbalance.
Forgetting the art of healing, forgetting the art of engagement, forgetting the art of listening, and the patients brood and grieve about that. So I believe that medicine has lost its human face.
Dr. Laun made clear that he wasn't blaming individual physicians. The dilemma for contemporary medicine, he said, is the societal arrangement by which doctors are forced into a rushed rhythm. That pace can rob the healer of an essential diagnostic resource, ample time needed to listen calmly to the patient.
I think the listening, as I have grown more experienced in medicine, I become to realize that of all the things in medicine, that's the most difficult. It's as complex as learning to be a great violinist.
By hearing out the patients, they can reveal more of their humanity.
When you are listening, you are sensitive to the unshed tear. You are sensitive to the anguished sort of cry that is not expressed. You're sensitive to a whole host of things going on. Because you're not listening to merely verbal. You're looking to the patient and cues that are given out.
According to Laun, being attentive and present with the patient could open a window into their relationships and their inner life, factors which drive so much of a person's lifestyle choices and ultimately the condition of their health.
Doctors, by virtue of having lost the art of listening, have lost appreciation of the power of words. Words are the most powerful placebos there are in medicine. Perhaps of all the drugs available in medicine, there's nothing more powerful than a word.
Dr. Lown encouraged fellow physicians to use hope-giving words when caring for patients, a nugget of wisdom that resonates especially now. Numerous reports say he suffered from congestive heart failure and died in his home in the Boston area. He leaves a son, two daughters, and several grandchildren. They will hold a public memorial service after COVID restrictions are lifted. Today in Lewiston, Maine, the town where he attended high school, the Bernard Lown Peace Bridge still stands across the Androscoggin River. For Here and Now, I'm David Freudberg.
Tina and I are back hosting the Golden Globes.
What a year for movies.
Oh, hold on. I think you read that wrong. It's what? A year for movies?
It's Hollywood's most...
Amy Poehler and Tina Fey will be hosting the annual Golden Globe Awards this weekend. But the Globes and the organization that operates them, the Hollywood Foreign Press Association, has been under increased scrutiny this week after a Los Angeles Times investigation alleged corruption, self-dealing, and conflict of interest. Joining us now to talk about the Golden Globes is NPR's TV critic, Eric Deggans. Hi, Eric. Nice to have you.
Good to be here.
So what are the allegations here against the Hollywood Foreign Press, the group behind the Golden Globes?
Well, they are numerous. And the basic contention is that it's a small group. It's only about 87 people. And that they've been, on purpose, very restrictive about their membership. You don't have much of a sense of who some of these people represent. They are given a lot of gifts from studios and celebrities who want Golden Globe nominations and want favorable results in the contest. They're taken on junkets and put up in luxury hotels. There's allegations that some members tried to scalp their Golden Globes tickets for thousands of dollars. And on top of all of that, the organization takes in a lot of money because the award ceremony is broadcast on NBC. And so members are paid to serve on committees, to screen films. And those fees can range in the thousands of dollars for each member. Mm. And that's something that nonprofit organizations are not really supposed to do. So there's a lot of allegations against them, and the group has denied the more serious allegations. But these are things that people have whispered. Publicists have whispered about the group for many years.
Well, that's right. And courting members of the Hollywood Foreign Press is somewhat of a ritualized pursuit in Hollywood. But with these stories of the gifts and the self-dealing and the allegations of many different things, I mean, this really seems to have crossed a line here, Eric.
Yeah, of course there have been concerns that they've violated tax law.
Right.
So I think there have been calls for the IRS and federal authorities to take a look specifically at what they're doing. It is hard to judge what they've done, in part because they're not very transparent. They haven't released a list of their membership, for example. And one thing that the Los Angeles Times pointed out is that they have no black members. They have members who are not white. But they don't have any black members. And this is at a time when black creative people are having quite a moment in film and television between films that are expected to be in Oscar contention, like Spike Lee's The Five Bloods and Ma Rainey's Black Bottom and the TV show I May Destroy You. And those films and TV projects did not get a lot of attention from the Golden Globes nominations. And people are wondering if that lack of diversity is one reason.
Right. And just to accentuate that, just 87 members are actually picking the winners and losers of the Golden Globe Awards?
And the allegation is that they are purposefully very small, that there are serious international journalists who have tried to join this group and who have not been allowed to join it. And in fact, one journalist sued the group over it. And there's an indication that perhaps they're not allowing serious journalists to join because they know those journalists would not tolerate some of the practices that they have come to accept. And, you know, I would say, you know, I'm a critic and I'm a member of the Television Critics Association, for example. And we had a period many, many years ago where TV outlets were giving us a lot of gifts at some of the functions that we had. And as a group, we came together and said, you know, you can't give us gifts above a certain dollar figure. We don't really want to have a sense that you're buying our opinions by giving us a bunch of things. We were very cognizant of the idea that it looks bad for a group of journalists to be given a bunch of gifts by the people that they are ostensibly covering.
So after all these new revelations, Eric, do you wonder about the credibility of the Golden Globes itself and the Hollywood Foreign Press, a group of, you know, are they really fair critics when it comes to Hollywood films and TV?
Well, I think that's the question that people are asking. And certainly, you know, critics like myself have criticized their picks in the past, and we've pointed out all these allegations that they are swayed by celebrity, that they're swayed by being taken on junkets. The LA Times noted that this TV show called Emily in Paris that critics weren't all that hot about and that got a couple of Golden Globe nominations. Well, 30 of the members were supposedly taken on this junket to a 5-star hotel in Paris and things like that. So you do wonder what impact junkets like that will have on their votes. The Golden Globes are considered sort of the gateway to the Hollywood Film Awards process. So if you win a Golden Globe, or if you're nominated, there's some momentum to your project, and that the Academy voters for the Oscars might pay attention to it. So if TV shows do well in the Golden Globes now, that's momentum for that contest. So there's a sense that they're kind of gatekeepers in a way. And if they can be swayed by junkets and gifts and all this sort of thing, then it sort of puts the lie to the idea that the best TV show or film is winning these contests.
Eric Deggans is NPR's TV critic. Eric, really nice to have you on. Thanks for your analysis today.
Thanks for having me.
Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR Boston in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Jane Clayson.
And I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now.